Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
Kelly Ayotte burst on the national political scene in 2010. The Attorney General of New Hampshire, she was elected to the United States Senate and had a very, very active term there, was a great ally of Senator John McCain and Lindsey Graham, was considered a vice presidential prospect in 2012, and then lost her seat in 2016, narrowly to Governor Maggie Hassan. Senator Ayotte was a visiting fellow at the Institute of Politics. I sat down with her this week to talk about her career, her fateful decision not to endorse Donald Trump in the election, and whether she had any regrets about that. Kelly Ayotte, so good to see you here at the Institute of Politics. You have the fresh, relaxed look of someone who is out of Washington.
It's amazing, David. I really appreciate being here. But there is something that all of a sudden that crease in your brow gets a little more relaxed.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that is good. I want to ask you about the journey that took you there, mm-hmm. and which began in New Hampshire.
Yes.
Your mom was... This is kind of unusual, but she was active, right? She was a lobbyist or...
Yeah, so she worked for... She's a great lady. My parents divorced when I was 6 years old. And so I was always with my mom. And she never finished college, but then started with... It was then New England Telephone, but became Verizon, and then... other configurations, but worked her way up through the company from, basically a service rep to eventually did government relations for the company in New Hampshire. So that was her, her career background. And then when she retired from that, she worked with, some other folks and did some of that for some clients in Concord. So that was her background, but I don't even think I knew what that meant growing up. It wasn't like we had huge political discussions at the dinner table.
Yeah. So politics wasn't something that you knew from an early age?
Not at all. My mom, may have had this job working for a company representing them on issues, but never worked on a campaign. I mean, ironically, the first campaign I ever worked on was my own. And so, not a political family in that. And even at the kitchen table, we talk about issues, but not, not kind of this campaign or that campaign.
And you went off to Penn State?
Yes.
Why there?
So my stepfather, my mom remarried when I was 9 years old, and my stepfather's a Penn State grad. So I would hear him talk about Penn State all the time. Love Penn State, love Penn State football. And of course, as a teenager, I was like, oh, Penn State. And I didn't want to go see the college, but we were on the college tour up and down the East Coast. And my stepfather, Jim, was like, well, you got to at least check it out. So the story is I'm sleeping in the back. We get on campus. I wake up. I get out of the car. I look around and I was like, I only applied there. I got in.
Yeah. I hear that all the time from people.
I just knew. I walked in. I'm like, okay, this is where I'm going to college.
They just see a place and they say, this is the... Yeah. My own son, I saw it happen with him. And then somewhere along the line, you decided that you were going to go to law school.
I did. When I was much to one of my professors, who was one of my mentors in college's chagrin, because he wanted me actually to go on and become a professor. And I told him that I was going to be, go to law school and that I'd be a lawyer. And he's like, you want to be a lawyer? Why would you want to do that? And so I realized...
Why did you want to do that?
Because I, you know, first of all, I was a political science major, and I didn't, and I had a minor in business, but I didn't have any thoughts of running for office or anything at that point. But I realized that, you know, being a lawyer, there's so many areas you can be a lawyer, and you can be an advocate, and you can advocate for your client. And I enjoy doing that. I enjoyed, you know, finding a cause, something I care about. Even in college, I was involved in student government. So that just seemed like a natural fit of what I would do next.
You know, I should have, before I asked you about that, I you talked about your parents getting divorced when you were six, and that you were always with your mom. How did that shape your sensibilities? Was your dad around at all?
My dad, he's a wonderful guy, but he lived in Oregon. And my mom, he went to graduate school in Oregon. So when they separated, my mom went back to where she's from, which is New Hampshire. So I would, you know, visit my dad, but I was really always much more with my mom. And it did shape me, because my mom always worked. You know, I would, like, after school, I'd come home, you know, take care of myself. I was always got the sense of independence from my mom. And she very much instilled with me just sort of the whole idea of, you know, you can do it, you know, you just go do it. And so I just think her values were imparted on me there. And I saw her work really hard. And even, I remember even being a kid when, you know, when she was single, you know, it's hard. We moved in with another woman who was widowed, and her kids, like when we were, and I remember that too. So it's just a different perspective, I think, of just kind of be able to stand on your own two feet and figure out, you know, how do you do it, and how do you be independent?
So you went off to Villanova Law School.
Yes.
And you clerked for a Supreme Court justice.
Yeah, state Supreme Court justice, Justice Horton. Yeah.
And then you went into a firm and started working on litigation.
Yeah, I clerked when I first got out of law school, and then I spent about 4.5 years in a private firm and in their litigation department. And fortunately, like many things, I discovered what I really wanted to do with my life, because one day I got handed, I got the opportunity to work on a court-appointed criminal case in that big firm, and it ended up in a 3-month trial in federal court, and I handled, I was the junior lawyer on it, very serious criminal case, and I handled the DNA evidence. And once I did that trial, it was like, there's something else I need to do with my life. I really wanted to go work in the public sector, and that's how I ended up at the Attorney General's office.
This was Stephen Burke, is that the...
Yeah, it was a very serious case. You know, these men from Charleston, Massachusetts, were charged with committing bank robberies up and down the East Coast, and part of the predicate acts are racketeering conspiracy. 2 armored car guards murdered, and 6 defendants. And so I was the junior lawyer along with a senior lawyer representing Stephen Burke, who was really alleged to be the leader of this group that was committing these bank robberies. And so it changed what I realized I wanted to do with my life. And, you know, I always say, especially I had the chance to talk to some law students this morning, and I said to them, you know, you got a great opportunity to do, there's so much you can do with a law degree. So find something you care about and that you're passionate about. And that case made me realize that I wanted to go be a prosecutor.
Yeah, you went from the defense side to the prosecutor side.
I did.
What made you make that decision?
I saw how important the justice system was. And I also saw that I wanted to see justice done, make sure that it was administered fairly and done well when people were wronged. And that's what I got the passion for, but it also gave me immense respect for what defense counsel does. So I was always a strong advocate, even when I was attorney general, for the role of our public defender's office, because our system does not work unless you have excellent advocacy on both sides.
Now, your attorney general's office is different than some states in that you handle criminal acts like homicide. I mean, they have their own homicide unit, and you very quickly were heading up their homicide unit.
Yeah, it's a little different. I mean, New Hampshire is different in a couple of regards. First of all, it's an appointed position. So I believe there's only a handful of states in the nation, maybe 5, that are appointed rather than running for office. And also, you're the chief law enforcement officer and the chief legal officer. And as part of that, the homicide murder prosecutions have always been conducted out of the AG's office. And so there was a special unit, the homicide unit within that office, that worked on those cases. And because I had done a defense case where PCR DNA evidence was relatively new and I knew about it, I got put on murder cases very quickly.
Kind of grisly, isn't it?
Very grisly. And honest, these cases were very horrible cases. And I was, you know, a relatively young woman at the time. And I think about it now that I'm a parent, because today the worst case I ever prosecuted, which I will never forget, was a rape and murder of a six-year-old little girl. Mm. And this was before I was a mother. I think I was thinking about my trial partner the other day, and he had two little girls, and I'm like, how did he do it? So yeah, those cases are very difficult. And especially with the, you know, the surviving family members of they've gone through so much of making sure that they understand the process too, and feel like the trial is, you know, fair to them and fair to everyone.
One of the cases that you were involved in was quite a famous case, the Dartmouth
Yes.
murders. You know, we had this case in Chicago back in the 20s or 30s, the Leopold and Loeb case.
Yes.
Where there were a couple of students here right. at the University of Chicago who wanted to commit the perfect crime and killed a young boy. And Clarence Darrow ended up representing.
Very famous, troubling case. Yes.
Troubling, yeah. This has some parallels to that. It was a real murder mystery for a while. And then, well, will you tell the story?
It really was. So you had two picture, you know, kind of sleepy Hanover, and actually Aetna, which is right, essentially adjacent to Hanover. Beautiful home, two lovely professors, Half and Susanna Zantop. Half was an earth sciences professor, and Susanna was a German professor. And they were murdered in their home brutally, stabbed to death, throats slit, just a very horrible, bloody murder scene. And it really, the whole community, and not just the community, it shocked the community, but it actually shocked not the country and the world. I mean, we had press that came in on this case from around the world. It drew so much attention. And we didn't know who did it. We started with the obvious, who would want to do harm to them, who would know them, you know, and it was through good police work, through, you know, we were there for over 2 weeks before we had really a strong lead of connecting forensics at the scene and the purchase of these particular kinds of knives, because a sheath was left at the scene that connected us to these two teens in Chelsea, Vermont, which is a sleepy town in Vermont, just adjacent to Hanover over the border, where 16 and 17-year-old boys who otherwise you thought normal life, you know, never, no huge indications of trouble in their past, and come to find out they committed cold-blooded murder.
What was their motivation?
You know, it was one of those things that was very difficult to comprehend and understand even now, even though I know what happened. So the 17-year-old Robert Tulloch, who is actually serving a life sentence, he had talked to the younger one, James Parker. They wanted to see what it was like to kill someone. And they had this harebrained...
Really is like Leopold.
It was. They really did. What was it like to kill someone? And also a harebrained scheme that they were going to rob whoever they killed. And they were going to, you know, travel to Australia and do these kind of fantasy-like things. And so we never quite were able to fully understand, because it's so hard to comprehend that someone would commit such evil acts and not have, you know, some motivation, or you can obviously never...
Makes those cases harder to solve.
Very difficult to solve. We were only able to solve it because they made some mistakes on mm-hmm. the forensics on the scene and great police work. I mean, this case had the state police, the local police, the FBI came in. And I was, a pretty young woman at the time. I had just finished trying a first-degree murder case. And I'll never forget, I was waiting for the jury with my trial partner at the time, and the attorney general called me. And I, you know, when you're in a trial, it's like so intense. You're right. Just like, you're not doing anything. You're like eating ramen noodles and like going and
yeah, it's like a campaign.
Yeah, it's a campaign, yes. David. A trial is yes. like that. And so I was just already kind of really exhausted. And the attorney general said, "Did you hear what happened in Hanover? I want you to go up and handle this case." And so I got thrust in this. And what I didn't appreciate at the time was just the media. I'd never experienced. We didn't know anything. And every day I'd have to go out there and try to answer questions when I knew nothing. Like, and you know, so that really annoyed the press. And that was probably my first experience with good training. Yes. I had no idea that this would, you know, be something that I would have to do in the future for other reasons. But yeah, no, it was a very tough case. But it was a case that drew a lot of attention in our state.
And drew attention to you.
Interesting enough, it did.
Drew the governor's attention, right?
It did. I mean, I was, again, when I was at the attorney general's office, my job, I think, especially important when you're administering the law, when you're prosecuting, it cannot be political in any way. It has to be done very independently. And so I was not involved in politics at all. In fact, I was a registered independent at the time. I wasn't even a registered Republican. And I got a call out of the blue with the then newly elected governor's transition team. Hey, we've noticed you. Do you want to come interview to be the governor's legal counsel? So that was my first real injection in the political world.
But you didn't stay there very long.
I didn't.
Apparently in your interview, you told him that you'd like to be attorney general sometime. Crazy. We should point out in your state, the governor appoints the attorney general.
The governor appoints the attorney general, confirmed by the executive council, because we have 5 elected executive counselors throughout the state.
So that was a pretty big move to go in there and say that.
Well, it was kind of crazy, but I knew one thing, having served in the attorney general's office. If you come in the New Hampshire attorney general's office, you will see on the wall the pictures of every attorney general. Going back to, like, I think a guy on a horse, like, you know, way back in the 1800s.
But probably all guys. Yeah.
And I'd go up to see the attorney general to brief him on something, and I was like, why is it all guys? And so when I was asked to interview for the governor's legal counsel, I decided, okay, I don't know that I want to do that job, but it's a very interesting job. Many people would want to do it. So what I really want to do is serve as attorney general. But I was kind of young and crazy, naive. It was crazy. So I went in, and when I interviewed, I said, I'm really honored that you have me come in for this job, but I think you should make me attorney general. And they kind of laughed at me, you know, but they liked my spunk, and the governor offered me the job as legal counsel.
But pretty quickly appointed you deputy attorney general.
Yes. What I realized when I went over to be legal counsel for the governor is that believe it or not, I missed the attorney general's office. I did one legislative session with him. So I actually learned a lot about how the legislature operates through that in the governor's office. But the political world just wasn't what I wanted to do. And so fortunately, he appointed a new attorney general. And that new attorney general wanted to have me come back and be the deputy. And the governor was supportive of that. So that's how I ended up being the number 2 in the office.
Well, this business can be serendipitous.
Well,
this business of life.
You realize quickly that life is serendipitous.
Because he ran into some problems.
He did. Yeah, it was a very hard time. I was actually expecting our first child, Kate, who's now 13, and I was literally 6 months pregnant. And so the then Attorney General Peter Heed ran into some problems at a domestic violence conference, and which I was not at the time. And so it was a hard situation. I mean, he ended up resigning. It became a big controversial issue. I was appointed the first
when
woman.
When we say, that's euphemistic, when we say ran into problems, he misbehaved at this conference. And so.
Well, yeah, that was the, and so I was thrust into a very difficult situation because here he was, I was his deputy, and this happened, obviously, I wasn't there. And so it was a very difficult situation. And so I was appointed the first woman attorney general. And I was 7 months pregnant at the time. And so not only was I appointed the first woman more quickly than I ever thought I would, it really changed my, I can assure you, my maternity leave pretty quickly. Yeah. And then I dealt with all the questions about, you know, what's it, you know, not only being the first woman, but here you are, how are you going to manage the having a baby and, yeah. and doing and being, you know, attorney general?
It's interesting. And because
so many
is,
of those questions yeah. that we probably face less of them now, but it was amazing all the questions I got.
How did you handle it?
You know, very, first of all, I had a lot of help. Like my husband is very supportive, but my parents live pretty close, aunts and uncles, a lot of family help. And I also, you know, I think the AG's office was a pretty family friendly office. I mean, I joked recently, I was at a women's conference talking about this, but my office is the attorney general's office. I had just had a baby. I had to set up a mini fridge in the little office to the side so that I could, you know, pump so that I could bring milk home to my kids. So we all of a sudden the office was thrust into, we have a woman who's attorney general and we're just going to deal with it. And fortunately for me, I had been in the office. I knew the team. They knew me. So we just all worked together.
You know, I've written about this. One of the great regrets I have is the kind of sacrifices I asked my family to make,
and it's true.
My kids in
it's
particular,
hard.
When I was coming up and doing my career and working on campaigns, which were all enveloping and so on. And I wish I had those years back.
It's intense.
But having said that, it was considered excusable for husbands to do that. And the burdens fell more heavily, certainly fell heavily on my wife, but the standards were different. And
the standards were different. They still are different. I mean, we've come a long way on these issues, but there's still, I think, some residual different standards out there. And let me give you the example. I had my daughter, Kate. I was attorney general for 5.5 years. So our daughter, Kate, and then I was actually reappointed, not by Republican governor, by a Democratic governor, Governor Lynch.
Yes, twice.
I served under Governor Lynch, actually, longer than I served under Governor Benson. But then I had my son, also, Jacob, when I was attorney general. So the public was sort of used to me being in this very public position of having children. But when I ran for office and my first primary, it was a really tough race. And it surprised me and it surprised my husband even more how many people asked me, what's going to happen to your children? Because I had held a very public position where I had clearly had children. I was the chief law enforcement officer of the state and had significant responsibility. And so I was really surprised how often I got that question. And of course, my male counterparts never got that question.
Yeah.
And the most offended person by that question was my husband, who sometimes would be at these events, and he's like, I mean, I'm a parent too, you know, so.
Yeah. I mean, well, just to be clear, what I was saying before wasn't that the standards are different then and now, although I think there are differences.
Well, I
it's
think
that the standards
been,
are different between men and women.
Well, right? They are. I mean, they are. First of all, you're asked different questions. Their standards are different. And when you're a professional woman and when you're, for example, running for office, you could have, you know, men who have young children and they're never going to be asked the questions I was asked. And they're not going to be judged in the same way on these issues. So it is different. It's different standard. I mean, this is, and it's challenging. It's really challenging for men and women, but women especially, I think, of trying to figure out, how do I have a career? And, you know, how do I be a good mom and how do I be...
I think we just saw an example of it. Our Senator, Tammy Duckworth, just had a baby. Which I think they had to change the rules
on the Senate
so she
floor.
Could bring the baby onto the Senate so floor. She,
right, exactly. I think it's wonderful that they did that. Long time coming. You know, these are changes that we see happening. And
some would argue that there have been babies on the Senate floor before. They were just
well,
fully grown.
I didn't want to go there, David. But you know what I loved about, like, for example, being the first woman attorney general, people would always ask about that. I said, there's only one great thing about being the first is I'm not going to be the last. I mean, you know, that's these things, these ways get paved. And so, you know, Tammy Duckworth, it's wonderful that she's able to really to have a baby, be a senator and that hopefully the body will support her on all that.
Were the expectations of you as a woman on issues challenging as well? I know that you've had a fairly consistent position on abortion,
mm-hmm.
and that position has been that it should be limited to cases of health, life.
Right, and rape and incest, yeah.
Yeah, and that led you into some battles when you were Attorney General with Planned Parenthood and others.
Yeah, although interesting, yeah, I argued a case before the U.S. Supreme Court, and the name of the case is Ayotte versus Planned Parenthood, and the...
You'd be the Ayotte.
I'd be the Ayotte.
Yes.
And that case was less, although I am pro-life, and that case was less about my I think people thought it was about my ideological viewpoints, but it really wasn't. For me, it was more the legislature passed a law, and my job as Attorney General was to defend it. And so that's how I viewed my role there, in the sense that the legislature had passed a parental notification law, and so I defended it to the United States Supreme Court. So I think that as Attorney General, you do have to respect the separation of powers, and there are times you have to defend laws as long as they're not, you know, blatantly unconstitutional. You have to defend them even if you don't agree with them. So yes, I agreed with that law, but that was less of why I brought that case than I felt that was my responsibility.
Because you did deal with violent crime, I'm sure the issue of guns came up quite a bit as well.
Mm-hmm.
New Hampshire's a hunting state.
Yes.
NRA is strong there.
Yes.
You've been highly rated by them over the years. What is your view of where we are now? You saw what happened in Florida.
Sure.
These kids have been pretty compelling, Parkland students, in calling attention to gun violence. And we're sitting here in Chicago, so we're well aware of it. Explain the dynamic of this, because, you know, there's almost unanimous support, if you believe polling, for things like universal background checks. There's strong consensus on things like bump stocks, that they should be banned. There's a fairly strong body of thought that semi-automatic weapons should not be commercially available. Why does none? Tell me what the pressures are on public officials to maintain the status quo.
Well, I actually think that this whole debate, number one, in some ways, there's a little bit of a disconnect of where you live in the country and what your perspective is. And so the issue itself has also been wrapped up in how people feel about their individual rights and their freedom. And that's driven by perhaps what your experience is with firearms or what your background is. And so in an inner city, you're probably going to feel different than you do in rural New Hampshire, based on your experience and what you see happening. So I would describe it, you know, less in terms of pressure. I mean, I think that the pressure piece is it's on both sides. I mean, I frankly have been, you know, attacked more on the gun issues by the left than probably almost anyone.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand that. I mean, there's lots of pressure to bear on both sides, but I think it's more about where people in the American public come on this. It's more about constituents than any pressure.
But on some of these things, like I mentioned, like on universal background checks, there seems to be as close to a unanimous view as any issue that I've seen, and yet we can't come together around it.
One of the reasons that we're not that I don't see us coming together is there. You may not fully agree with everything that one side wants to do, like say that the Democrats want to do on gun control, but there's a lot of common ground that isn't being dealt with, even on the background check issue, on the bump stock issue, on the mental health issue, on the issue of education and prevention. And I think that why aren't they for it? Because people are concerned, for example, on the universal background check issue, that that's somehow going to lead to a gun registry. And so there are different viewpoints that my constituents have on this issue. But what frustrates me when I look at it and I look at how this debate has developed is there are things that maybe don't go as far as one side or the other wants to go that could be done now and today that would be voted on and voted yes. They did some of it in the appropriations bill and the omnibus, but I think that we're in this situation where it's become too much of a political football instead of saying, I don't fully agree with you, or you don't fully agree with me. Why don't we at least start where we agree? And then you can keep fighting like hell. You want universal background checks, then keep pushing for it. And I'm going to keep worrying about the registration implications. And there's middle ground there somewhere in between. I don't know if it's in between or somewhere.
But I
think there's a disconnect between that somehow there's a feeling that if you aren't willing to do all these things, then somehow you don't want public safety or you don't, you know, care about safety. And for me, it gets frustrating because I've lived it. I've been a prosecutor. I understand the issues. And one of the biggest gaps we have is actually enforcing. I mean, people think it's an excuse, but every one of these cases, I can tell you, if we actually put more resources into enforcing as a first step, it would be a big step.
What is the case, as I mentioned, you know, the polling is overwhelming. So I hear you when you say people are worried about gun registries, although it doesn't exactly show up in the polling. But what is the argument against having, I mean, 60% of gun sales, there are background checks. There's 40% or so, or some percentage that's not fully accurate, but whatever. There is a percentage of gun sales that don't go through background checks. Here in Chicago, a lot of weapons that are recovered come from gun shows in Indiana, for example. Like 50% of the guns come in from Indiana. What is the argument for not just saying no? Every commercial sale, whether it's at a gun show or a gun shop, should just go through the same process.
Yeah,
I'm just gonna try one more time. I don't want to get into like political haunches, but
no. I mean, I think someone like me, I'm for background checks. I didn't end up voting for the Manchin-Toomey proposal because I had some issues with it. But I think there is a way to get to where we have background checks that can allay people's concerns that universal means. I mean, even issues like some of the biggest issues we have aren't going to be addressed with the background check issue. I mean, mm-hmm. Unfortunately, if you look at all these incidents, they're not going to be solved with the background check. Most of these people would not have been discovered in the background check system. That was not the issue in most of these mass that I can think of as I think about the facts of each of them.
Yeah, although if you look at state by state and some of the analysis that's been done, there is some percentage. Like it's surprising how many people with felonious backgrounds and sometimes violent felonious backgrounds
try to buy guns.
Right.
Right.
And get stopped by background checks.
Right.
So if you extend them, then you'll catch
David,
more.
If you prosecute them too, we'll get more. People know there's no teeth in that. So few prosecutions happen.
Well, I'm for that.
Of people that violate those laws.
Yeah, I agree.
I don't
think it's an either or thing.
Yeah, I don't think it's an either or thing either, but both sides should get together and figure out what can they agree with here. Because I don't want a felon to get a gun. Of course not. I was a prosecutor. We lawful gun owners don't want a felon to get a gun. And they also want...
I think that's why most of them say, yeah, we're for universal.
They also don't want dangerously mentally ill people to have a gun. And in my state, we had a list that still the people who were adjudicated dangerously mental ill were never on the list. And that, you know, that needs to be fixed too.
And I think you did support the no-fly, no-buy...
I did. I supported
that. Keep people who are on no-fly list from buying
I supported
weapons.
That. That's why I think, you know, when people talk about, like, for example, The NRA didn't agree with that, but I thought it made sense. I mean, I dealt with national security issues. I was concerned about what happened, you know, in Orlando, mm-hmm. and I thought that that was something that would be important to prevent that in the future.
Your decision to run for the Senate. So you, here you are, you're an independent, you're not political, so determinedly not political.
Yeah.
And so what made you decide to, I know you were heavily courted, that's one thing, but.
I ran for the Senate because, well, first of all, I was actually quite surprised when Judd Gregg decided he wasn't going to run for another term. I mean, he obviously was nominated at one point to be Commerce Secretary, and that kind of fell apart. But I have a lot of respect for him, and I thought for sure he would then run for another term of the Senate. So I was surprised by it. I have to tell you, though, I was looking at what was happening with the country, and I didn't agree with what was happening. I didn't like the turn on the healthcare piece, money spent on the stimulus. A whole host of issues came up where philosophically I just didn't like what was happening. And then there were people who came to me and said, you should do this, surprisingly. And the probably one of the most important people who said, I think you could do this, is Judd Gregg, who I had a lot of respect for, who was my predecessor. But at the end of the day, it was really my husband and I who decided we would do it. And it was kind of crazy because I had never run for office before. And I had to resign my position as Attorney General, and I took a year and a half off from work. And we just ran the numbers at home, put them on the wall. Could we go from 2 to 1 income for a year and a half? My husband has a small business. And do we want to do this? And I didn't actually know fully what I was getting into, which was probably good because it's better not to know when you first run how crazy and hard it is. And so resigned my job and decided I would give it a shot.
And what did you learn about politics, about yourself, from the experience of running and then the experience of serving?
Yeah, I think the one thing about running is it really bears you open, meaning anything that you had for flaws, I mean, it's out there for people to see, and anything that you had for strengths are also out there. And what I learned from it is I learned a lot about myself, because you're put in situations where, in a campaign context, where you really have to convince people why they should vote for you, and why, what is it that you have to offer in representing them that they need to know about and be able to communicate effectively. And I learned a lot, and I think I learned a lot about how to communicate that I didn't know before. And then in terms of serving, I'd never been a legislator. So learning on being a senator, I think relationships matter. I think your ability to build coalitions matter, and doing your homework matters.
Yeah. And you have an interesting state, because you had a pretty active kind of cohort on the right. You had to win a primary in the first instance that was pretty competitive. And yet it's a swing state.
It's got both. It's a challenge on both fronts. So I won my first primary by 1,662 votes. It was really close. And but who's counting? And three guys that I ran against, one of them was a big self-funder, spent about $8 million against me. And so it was when, like, the Tea Party was almost in full force then, 2010. And so our state, the Republican primary electorate, they're conservative. I mean, they're, you know, they are probably not as conservative as you may find in other states in the nation down south or something like that, but they're a conservative electorate, and in a swing state. And so it really is a state that can go back and forth.
And you also walk a minefield if you're...
And also, in part because we have such an important role in the presidential election. I mean, this is a state where people are used to seeing you, and they're, you know, they're not impressed about you're a senator, whatever. They see presidential candidates, and they want to have the opportunity to ask you a question, and they expect you to be accessible. And so being out there, not having run for office before, even though I was in a public position as attorney general, really being out there so much is something you have to get used to when you run for office. And they, you know, obviously, even now I go to the grocery store and it takes me longer probably than your average person to do grocery shopping.
When you, in fact, I have to tell you, I was a reporter and I went into politics, and I covered a New Hampshire primary, and I went with one of the presidential candidates to a high school. And when it was over, I asked one of the kids how he felt, and he said, "Oh, very impressive." I said, "Would you vote for him if you could?" Because he wasn't even old enough to vote. And the kid was horrified. I said, "I haven't met all the candidates for president yet. I can't comment on this until I meet them all." Which
it's so true. And it was the same. It's the same way running for statewide office. I think especially in the primary context, you know, just because for the nomination of your party, I can say for either party, I think you really have to get out and reach out and touch people. And you know, I can't even name the number of debates and candidate forums I did in that primary.
Yeah.
It was like endless.
So in the Senate, you became, you were on the Armed Services Committee. You were, a strong ally of Senator McCain, Senator Graham. It was as if Senator Lieberman left and you took the slot in the Three Amigos.
Nobody can take Senator Lieberman's place, trust me. Okay.
But so I want to ask you a little bit about what you're what you're seeing now, because this is a very eventful moment. First in North Korea. And what is your, based on your experience, what are you seeing that encourages you, and what are the yellow lights that you would display?
What I'm seeing that encourages me is that an unconventional approach by President Trump has been a catalyst in part to get people to the table. And in part, I think a little bit of a fear about what he may or may not do.
The crazy man syndrome.
Is driving a discussion that needs to happen. So I'm encouraged by the fact we're in this position with the South Koreans and the North Koreans, you know, meeting with the Chinese, obviously stepping up a little bit more to get North Korea to the table. So whether we will get a result out of that remains to be seen. And I am skeptical of North Korea given their history. And, you know, other administrations have been in similar situations and they have not followed through North Korea, and they've used it as a subterfuge to get economic relief. So the jury's out, but I am encouraged by it.
Let me ask you this. The president is obviously very eager, and I want to go on record saying we all should be eager for a good result.
Of course, for the world and our country.
For the world and our country, but there is a concern, it seems to me, that in eagerness for a deal, you can accept a deal that is that ultimately is not a good deal, because, as you point out, the North Koreans are the least transparent regime on the planet. And their history has been to make representations and then not live up to them.
Right. Which is kind of how I felt on the Iran deal with Secretary Kerry.
No, we'll...
I felt he was overanxious for a deal. I think we could have had a better deal there.
But that deal, whether I know you disagree with it, and we'll talk about that in a second, was years in the making, and there were other nations involved
in
that process.
True, there were multilateral sanctions involved and process, yes.
Right. This is a very abrupt... So, I mean, we remember the State of the Union was in January, and the president was devoted. He had Otto Wambier's parents there, and he devoted a large portion of his speech to talking about the savagery of the North Korean leader, who he now calls honorable, who says he's being open.
Well, I do not think the president, in the anxiousness for a deal, should enter a deal that is not satisfactory, because we have allies that we cannot put in a position, like we can't undermine South Korea's security for the sake of a deal that's insufficient and our own security, because they have demonstrated last year they 17 ICBM tests. So that has the capability of hitting the United States of America. We cannot have a deal. So I will be as critical of this president as I was of President Obama if there's somehow a deal for the sake of a deal that has no teeth and is insufficient. And I just think the jury is out on it. And interestingly enough, I saw an interview the other day by former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, and I agree with her on this. I think the president does need to make sure that he is surrounded in this and leave the details to professionals who have studied North Korea for a long time, so that the terms of any agreement that are reached are real, they're verifiable, they're concrete, and so that North Korea can't use this as a subterfuge for legitimacy that it does not deserve.
Let's turn to Iran and the deal that you and I disagreed on, because we are where we are now. And Secretary Mattis, Secretary Pompeo, and he was the CIA director, and everyone involved in the administration seem to be in agreement that Iran is complying by the terms of that agreement. Do you think that the U.S. should pull out of that agreement? The deadline's coming up.
Well, the president has imposed a deadline of May 12th, right?
Yes.
And my view is that he has brought the Europeans to the table, and he should continue to push. There are, I think,
for side agreements,
there's a huge deficiency in that agreement. There's a couple of huge deficiencies. Number one, it's too short term. Iran's thinking long term about this nuclear program. One thing with the information that Prime Minister Netanyahu brought out in the last day or so, it's back in 2003, but the knowledge that they have on the nuclear program is
still
there.
Was that a secret to anyone? You must have known that.
No.
I don't think you were privy to the intelligence.
I will tell you.
The whole point of the agreement was that they were close to months away from
Obama. We wouldn't
have
entered the agreement. I don't know that there was anything surprising that the Iranians misrepresented their program. That was one of the reasons we were in this thing.
Right.
So that's not surprising.
Right.
But I think the point I would make from it, though, is they have the knowledge. They have the knowledge, and this agreement, essentially, we don't have the leverage on them between 10 and 15 years, depending on how you look at the agreement and how you interpret the agreement. In addition to that, one of the pieces of legislation I introduced in the Senate I thought was a huge deficiency in the program was we did nothing to address their missile program. And they are very close, if not, I'm not privy to the intelligence now, at the point of ICBM capability and ballistic missile capability. They've had a program. It's very far along. And we didn't deal with any of it. And they kept testing. So, and then there's obviously...
There are sanctions in place relative to these things.
They're very weak tea. Mm-hmm. They need to be stronger. They're not really dealing with the heart of it. And Iran will argue, by the way, that the deal, even though it didn't deal with it, dealt with it. They, in fact, wrote a letter to the UN, basically of that import, right after the agreement, saying if you try to impose on terrorism, our support for state terrorism or the or other issues, then we're going to view that as a breach of the agreement. So if I were, I believe the president is right to be critical of this agreement. I was critical of it from the beginning. I would like to see him say, use maximum leverage to address these serious deficiencies
in the
agreement.
But in the end, would you pull out of it?
I wouldn't balk.
What impact would that have on the North Koreans?
If they're not going to do it, if the Europeans aren't going to step up to deal with these other issues, then I would. I would support him in withdrawing from the agreement, because I think in the end they will balk and will want to do it.
And what impact would withdrawing from that have on the North Korean negotiations if the sense is that... That no agreement is necessarily sacrosanct.
I'm less worried about that. I understand that that's an argument that people are making. The reason that I am less worried about that is because North Korea is going to act based on its own self-interest. I don't think that if we pull out of the Iran agreement, that suddenly they're going to think the same president who's entered the agreement, who he's going to think the agreement is sufficient, is suddenly going to pull out of it. And in the end, for me, the president has been clear on this, that it's an insufficient agreement, and it may even put him in a tougher negotiation position with the North Koreans, saying, I will abide by an agreement if it's a tough agreement, but otherwise I'm not going to honor it. And we have to remember the context for all this, which is at the time of this agreement, it was an executive agreement. It was not approved as a treaty process. It was quite clear that there was a major part of the Senate that didn't like the agreement and was in opposition to it.
You ultimately did vote on that.
Yeah, I voted against it.
Right, right. But it was not sufficient numbers to overturn the agreement.
Yeah, but the way the legislation was set up was not, you know, not like a treaty approval. It was basically
And the last thing on this, we had President Macron here, Chancellor Merkel, both urging the president not to withdraw. Does it have an impact on our relationship with our allies if he does?
I think that it will have the impact, David. I believe the impact it's going to have is that they are going to want to address these other issues. And so this is an area where the president should be tough.
Speaking of the president,
I mean, the French, even in this context, didn't necessarily like all, they were the tough guys in this agreement. So they'd like to see, I mean, even President Macron has said that he would like to deal with the length of the agreement and some of these other issues that he views as outstanding as well.
Speaking of the president, you ran for re-election in a tough environment in 2016.
An understatement.
in a swing state. And one of the questions that sort of jammed you up was how to deal with him. You got asked a question in the debate about whether he was a role model.
Right.
And you kind of clutched on it and finally...
Yeah, no, I made a mistake. I think it just shows you when you're asked sort of a surprise question, you don't think about it. Because honestly, my initial answer was more about the role of the president. Yes, I could see as a role model because of the role of the president, not necessarily him in particular. And I quickly realized, I'm like, that wasn't what I meant to say. And of course, I had to hear about it the rest of the campaign on the TV. But
was it damaging?
It's hard to know in that election. It could be just as damaging as the fact that I didn't vote for him. Who knows? Mm-hmm. When you have such a close election.
Eventually, was it after the Access Hollywood tape? But you said you weren't going to vote for him.
So after the Access Hollywood tapes came out, I realized in my heart that I couldn't sleep about this. I mean, my background is I was a prosecutor. I've dealt with sexual assault victims, domestic violence. I was mother of then 12-year-old little girl. And I just decided that for me, it was more important for my family and especially my daughter to know where I stood than to think about this as winning an election. I mean, the political calculus, for me, it was just what I thought was the right thing to do based on what was in my heart. And that's what I did.
Do you have any regrets about that?
No.
And has your attitude changed at all toward him? Do you see him as a role model today?
No, I don't. I don't. And I have to say that as I've reflected even more so on that debate question that you get asked, it's really hard to find, unfortunately, role models in the political context. And I'm not sure that's where I want my children to turn
when it comes to
role models.
Yeah, but there's so many others.
But there's so many other areas where, you know, there are people that
I would rather have the president to be a role model.
Well, I think I would like everyone in public office to try to conduct themselves as a role model, of course.
You did get called back, probably unexpectedly, to Washington shortly after your election to shepherd Judge Gorsuch's nomination for the Supreme Court.
Well, you've already asked me about, obviously, what happened in the election, and you know where I stood, that I actually wrote in Vice President Pence in the election. And so I was as shocked as anyone that I got the call from the administration asking to be the Sherpa for Justice Gorsuch.
Maybe the president didn't know.
Oh, no, he knew. Because the one question I had was, has the president signed off on this before I decided to do it? Because I thought it was important, because it was a very important nomination for him. And for, you know, for me, it was going back, obviously, in the Senate right after having lost an election, and bringing Justice Gorsuch to 70 meetings in the Senate wasn't exactly how I thought I would spend my post-election time. But I got to know him well, and it was an honor to get to know someone of that caliber.
The reason that there was this vacancy was because, and you were in the Senate at the time, Justice Scalia died, as you know, at the beginning of 2016, and Senator McConnell took the position that he wasn't going to call the president's nomination of Merrick Garland for the court. Talk about the precedent of that. There's a great deal of anger, obviously, among the president's, among Democrats. It came up during the Gorsuch nomination. I'm sure it may have come up in some of the meetings that you sat in.
It came up repeatedly. It came out throughout. I mean, not surprisingly. My take on this is, first of all, I was in the Senate when Harry Reid changed the rules on the Circuit Court of Appeals and the district court judges. Basically, I didn't think the facts warranted it, and he pushed facts that weren't necessarily making his
case.
This
was to end the filibuster on those nominations.
But we had approved, I believe, as many judges, if I can recall my facts, as that had happened in the Bush administration. We had approved many judges at that time, so I didn't think what he did was warranted, and he did a lot to undermine the institution when he took that move. And he set the stage. He set the stage for what happened with Justice Gorsuch.
So you're saying what he did...
You have to understand the context.
No, I do.
Yeah.
But you're saying what he did was what caused McConnell to do what he did?
I'm not saying it's a direct causation. I just want to understand the history here. Mm-hmm. That started us down this road. And then, frankly, when Justice Scalia passed away unexpectedly before the election, with a lot at stake for the country with an upcoming election, presidential election, and a shift in the court, we know that whoever replaced Justice Scalia, if it were anyone appointed by President Obama, frankly, represented a shift in that court. And it was very significant.
You weren't in the Senate when Garland was...
I was. He was nominated.
Not for the appellate court.
No, I was not. I was not present in the Senate when he was approved as a circuit.
Because he was almost unanimous bipartisan.
But it's a completely...
Support.
I mean, that's a little bit of a red herring in the sense that just because you're approved for the Circuit Court of Appeals... You then have obviously a record of being a judge there, but also the implications of being a Supreme Court justice are so much greater, and the scrutiny is so much greater.
So here's the question. Where do we draw the line?
But now let me just say, David, I don't have a doubt in my mind that had the tables been turned with the same party configuration, with an upcoming election, and if the Democrats thought there was going to be a shift on the court, that there's not a doubt in my mind that Harry Reid would have done the exact same thing that Mitch McConnell did. So I felt that the sort of outrage, you know, for the system as a whole, I supported it because
I know
I
you
was
support
concerned.
It, but you, and you explain why, but that's a different question than whether it's healthy.
I don't like that the institution now has eliminated the 60 votes for Supreme Court and every judge. I think in
what about
the long
the
term
holding
of the
a
institution,
thing, a seat open for a year.
I think if you're heading into a presidential election, as close as that was the right decision to make.
So is there a line that you, is there like a time element that should be applied?
I'm not going to, obviously we'd have to look at what happens in each situation, but the thing that bothered me about it is the outrage on the other side. I have not a doubt in my mind they would have done the exact same thing.
Well,
so it's kind of hard
to... We'll never know. I just worry about, and you and I have talked about this, I just worry about... sort of the slow degradation of democratic institutions and norms. And we can talk about which party contributed the most or
it
when.
It took two parties to tango on this.
Right,
no
but doubt. But the end result is unhealthy.
Well, I think it would have been better for the long term of the Senate to maintain the 60-vote threshold on the judiciary as a whole. And there's no doubt that all of this contributed, both sides on this. And the reason I say that is that when the minority party does have a voice to some extent on who gets on the federal bench, you can understand where the president is going to have to really look at more consensus candidates than where we are now.
Mm-hmm. One person who I think that you would agree has been a role model in many ways has been John McCain, who was such a close ally of yours and sadly
finds... Well, that's true. That's very true. He's been, for me, certainly, and a mentor.
And he, you know, tragically, he's dealing with grave health issues now, but he just released a book. And in the book... He said he was very critical of the president.
I have to confess I've not yet read John's book, but...
One thing he said was he has declined to distinguish the actions of our government from the crimes of despotic ones. The appearance of toughness or a reality show facsimile of toughness seems to matter more than any of our values. Do you agree with that?
That's a lot of words there.
But it's a pretty simple idea.
Yeah, I mean... I believe, first of all, when it comes to, you know, where we are with the president, is that I would like him to demonstrate some character. You know, I would like him to, I think, like many Americans, to, you know, spend less time on Twitter and spend, you know, obviously. His words matter, and I would like his words to be inclusive. I would like them to be thoughtful. You know, for me, that is important, as I think it is for many Americans. There's still many policy issues I agree with him.
Well,
on.
You just spoke to.
I did. Yeah. I mean, I agree with, you know, but that doesn't mean that I necessarily would agree with how he says things and how he conducts himself sometimes.
The other thing that Senator McCain said that struck me was, I'm freer than colleagues who will face the voters again. I can speak my mind without fearing the consequences much, and I can vote my conscience without worry. And I thought that was an amazingly
candid observation,
mm-hmm. but it also speaks to the pressures that people come under. I mean, Senator Flake, for example, was critical of the president and found himself in a position where he didn't feel he could run for re-election in Arizona. Do you contemplate returning to public life? And is this environment discouraging to you?
I'm not contemplating anything right now other than I'm really feel blessed to have more time with my kids and my husband. So I don't know whether I'll return to public life. It was such a great privilege to serve for almost 20 years in public life between being a prosecutor, attorney general, and a senator, and to represent the people of New Hampshire. But I think one thing that they do know about me is that I will call it like I see it. And, you know, my decision in the last election, I don't know how it would have played out had I done it differently. But when you ask me, would I have changed my mind? No, I did it for my own moral compass and what I thought was right. So
tough though, isn't it, right now in the Republican Party? Because he is the dominant force in the Republican Party right now.
He is. I mean, he's the leader of our party, for sure. He's the president of the United States. And I, as an American, I want to see him succeed. Not just because I'm a Republican, but for our country. So I think for Republicans, they need to be who they are. They need to obviously decide for themselves where they're going to work for him and where they're going to work with him and where they disagree with him. I mean, I think we should be doing that with everyone in office because we've frankly not reaped the benefits of being just party line on any party. And especially when the president says things that aren't inclusive, we should, you know, be clear about that, that that's not who we stand for as a party.
Kelly Ayotte, it's great to be with you. Thank you so much for being with us at the Institute of Politics and inspiring some kids.
Thanks, David. Glad to be with you. Take care.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, part of the CNN Podcast Network. For more episodes of The Axe Files, visit cnn.com/podcast and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite app. And for more programming from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.